with the ultimate freedom to shape ourselves through our choices. Martin Heidegger sees us as projects, both a project in the sense of something to be done, but also in the sense of something you project. We are not what we are, but what we imagine ourselves to be in the future. We are our plans. What we do is not done for our present selves, but rather for our future selves. We are not who we are, but who we hope to be. We strive. We imagine. We plan. We save. We exercise. We work in order to create the self we want to be. That is just what it is to be human. But the world does not work according to our plans. Often it's not. We hope, and the universe says, nope. The best laid plans of mice and men. We cannot but strive. But more often than not, we fail. We metaphorically fall on our faces. The world metaphorically hits us on the head. The universe metaphorically pours cold water on our dreams. And what do we see when we watch the Stooges? Someone literally falling on his face, literally getting hit on the head, literally having cold water poured on him. We see this and we empathize because that sort of thing happens to us too. We laugh not because we delight in the suffering or the pain that's depicted. Rather, we laugh because life does that to us too. Solomon argues that the meaning of humor is ultimately laughing at oneself. Even when we're laughing at something or someone else, we laugh because there's an identification. We put ourselves in that place, and we know what that person's feeling. It's the interconnection that yields the humor. The human condition is to strive to be more than we are, and we regularly fail, all of us. Even those whom we admire for their successes know full well what it is to crash and burn. So, humor is the mutual acknowledgement of our inabilities. We're bound together as humans, not because of our dignity and grandeur, but because of our understanding of what it is to reach and fall flat. Instead of superiority theory, we can think of what Solomon is sketching here as the inverse, a sort of inferiority theory. We do not find humor funny because it gives us a sudden sense of glory, of being better than the butt of the joke, but rather because we're bringing ourselves down mentally to the level of the butt. We're empathizing with, not diminishing or ridiculing, the target of the joke. Solomon is viewing the slapstick humor of the Three Stooges through a lens akin to Cohen's joke intimacy. It may be because we usually joke with friends. So if I joke with you, it means we're friends. It might be because laughing is a positive emotional experience, and anyone who brings me joy will be someone I look upon fondly. Whatever the psychological explanation for the feeling of joke intimacy, it is a real phenomenon and seems to speak in favor of a view like Solomon's, in which humor is based on mutuality rather than the establishing of an uneven hierarchy as the superiority theory would suggest. Additionally, we can find some evidence for Solomon's sort of view in the nature of humor when we look at stand-up comedy. When you listen to much of the comedy that's out there today, it's largely comprised of self-deprecating humor, whether it's straight self-deprecation as in the routines of Richard Lewis or Mike Birbiglia, making fun of one's body like Louis Anderson or John Pinette, or admitting to cringe-worthy actions, thoughts, or mistakes, like we see in the work of Steve Carell. The joke, in all of these cases, is on the comedian, him or herself. The comedian works from a position of power. The comedian is on stage or on television. All attention is focused on the comedian. There's a difference between you in the seats and the comedian up here. There's a power differential in which you are inferior. In order to be funny, the comedian reestablishes the balance by telling jokes and stories that diminish the comedian in the eyes of any normal listener. The comedian is brought down from a position of superiority to your level or below. It's only then that you can laugh at someone who had been above you. Consider the opening joke from this lecture, the one about the fictional show Who Wants to Marry a Philosopher. In the story I was telling, I was elevating myself. Not wanting to seem like a braggart, I added a line which brought me down. It says to the audience, I may have been good or lucky enough to get past the first round of the audition for the game show, but don't think too highly of me. Remember, I'm still a philosopher, and philosophers are poor. So, I'm just a normal person like you. There are some comedians who pretend to maintain their superiority. Steve Martin's routines from the 1970s or James P. Connolly do this bit where they comically overbrag. They make themselves absurd by trying to pretend to be so much better than you, realize that they're completely full of hot air, and establish their inferiority by trying so hard to establish their superiority. But for the bit to work, they have to end up being the butt of their own joke. It's very hard to be funny with a story of success. Clowns fall down, failing in what they're trying to do. Acrobats stay up, successfully pulling off amazing, daring feats none of us could. Only one of these two is humor. Now, I dabbled in stand-up for several years and took to trying to develop a routine at a local open mic in Baltimore. Former student of mine was pursuing his PhD at Johns Hopkins University and would come out to see me perform. One night after my set, he said the last thing I wanted to hear. He said, "When I see you up there, I see a college professor." This was worrisome. College professors, in the minds of most people, are authorities. The comedian starts with an advantage in status by being on stage and has to overcome it, bringing him or herself down to the audience's level with the joke. But what my student was telling me was that my presence, my bearing because of my job, was putting me even farther away from the equalization in status needed for humor. A professor grades you, judges you. That means that he's above you. If I came off as a professor on stage, my comedy was doomed. So I had to work for several years trying to develop an alternative persona for my comedy work. I'm not sure it worked, which is why you see me on The Great Courses and not with a half-hour comedy special on Comedy Central. But it speaks to Solomon's inferiority theory. We can sum it up this way. Humor results when a person placed in a position of superiority, acts in such a way as to knowingly bring himself down to the level of the audience with a mistake presented in order to inspire empathy or connection. Now, that certainly does account for a number of examples of humor. But is it successful as a humor theory? Is it necessary? Is it sufficient? To determine whether the inferiority theory is necessary, we need to see if an act needs to satisfy the condition in order to be humorous. Is it possible to find an example of humor which does not involve a description of a mistake designed to bring the performer down to the level of the audience? Sure. Exactly the sorts of example the superiority theory advocates used as their evidence. Consider humorous insults.
You so skinny when you go to the doctor for an x-ray, he just holds you up in front of the window.
In this case, we don't have the empathic connection anywhere involved. The purpose of the humor is to knock someone else down. We do laugh at others sometimes. Or we can think of pun-based jokes.
I went to a jazz-themed seafood restaurant last night. The Fluke Ellington was really good, but I was not about to try the salmonella.
In cases like this, we don't have superiority or inferiority, just fun plays on words. It seems like these cases are counterexamples to any claim of necessity for the inferiority theory. Okay, but what about sufficiency? Is satisfying the proposed definition we've put forward enough to be humor? Could there be a case which does everything the condition requires and still is not humorous? Again, the answer is yes. Sometimes I'll have a student in my office who cannot understand why he got something wrong on a logic exam. I'll point out the error. usually not a mistake of understanding, just a silly slip-up like copying something wrong, and the student will be embarrassed. I'll tell a story about a time I made a similar mistake. The story isn't funny, but because we've both made similar blunders and both know about the boneheadedness of the other, there's now an empathic connection. This satisfies the condition, but is not a joke. But this same sort of thing could also be said as a joke. For example, when I teach truth functional logic proofs, there are two rules of inference that look very similar, except for two small differences, one of which is that the conclusion of one has a negation and the conclusion of the other does not. Now, if you were to mistake one for the other, you will introduce a negation that does not belong and make your proof unsolvable. I could warn students in a non-humorous way, as in the example above, where I recount the time I made this error on a logic exam in graduate school. Or I could tell the story the way I do. Let me tell you of a graduate student, to remain nameless, who made this error on an exam. With time running short, he looks back at a proof that he realizes should not take more than 8 lines, but he's now on line 64. He rechecks his work and realizes he made this very mistake. The unnamed graduate student used to have more hair. If you don't want to look like this, I suggest you be careful in applying these rules. The warning always gets a laugh when I say it that way in the classroom, and hopefully some of my students get higher grades because of it. So, the condition could be satisfied and have it sometimes be a joke and sometimes not be a joke. Because it can sometimes not be a joke, that means that the condition is not sufficient. So, the inferiority view is neither necessary nor sufficient. But it does shed some light on important elements of the nature of humor. Humor is essentially a social endeavor. It requires a joker and an audience, and the result of a successful joke yields what Ted Cohen called joke intimacy, which leads people who share a laugh to forge a sort of friendly relationship. Whatever ends up being our final account, if there is one, this is philosophy after all, it will surely have to include these elements.
Lecture 12, Play Theory.
Safety.
So, what's this next one about?
Play theory. The idea that humor is just a form of play.
And who said that?
Older several. Aristotle, St. Thomas Aquinas.
A saint? There's a funny saint?
He was funny. He had in one of his books, he has this question. Which is more powerful, wine, the king, or women? He says, some people argue that it's wine because it has the greatest effect on people. Others say that it's the king because he can have people put to death. But the right answer is women because they control the king.
And he was a priest?
Well, I guess celibacy does have an upside. Humor is fun. I'm a philosopher. I say deep things. We all love a good laugh. When things are tense, we'll often try to relax people with a joke. We love to be amused. This is one of the reasons why philosophers have long ignored humor. It was seen as too light to be worth the effort to think about. Now, in logic, there's a reasoning error called equivocation. Equivocation is where you change the meaning of a word in the middle of an argument. Suppose I said, tables are furniture. There are tables in my statistics book. Therefore, there's furniture in my statistics book. It sounds like a good argument at first, but we realize that the word table changed its meaning from a raised surface on which to place things to a rectangular array of numbers. We equivocated on the word table, and the argument, of course, is not a good one. The same sort of error has been to blame for the lack of status afforded the philosophy of humor. The argument is, humor is funny, and funny is the opposite of serious. Philosophers only study serious topics, therefore philosophers do not study humor. But in this argument, the word serious changes its meaning from that which is amusing to that which is important. Humor has wrongly been seen as unimportant because it's pleasant, because it's happy, because it is playful. Humor is play, and play is not seen by many professionals as a topic sufficiently august to warrant rigorous philosophical contemplation. But starting in the 1970s, philosophers who started thinking about the nature of sports began to think seriously about the nature of play. When we play a game, we're both very serious, but removed from the real world and thus not serious at all. The winner of a game does not actually win anything outside of the game. The strange rules and restrictions belong not to the real world, but to the play world. In basketball, you can't move without bouncing the ball. But in football, you have to hold on to the ball. Why? No real reason other than that's the strange set of rules we've agreed to live by for the short time we are within the lines of the field or the court. In sports, we create an artificial goal to achieve and then rule out all of the easiest and most efficient ways of achieving that goal. In real life, this is stupid, but it's constitutive of playing. Philosophers of humor read works like Johan Huizinga's foundational book Homo Ludens from the first half of the 20th century, and more contemporary works by the likes of Bernard Suits and Fred D'Agostino, and thought that they could form a humor theory along the same lines. They take as a starting point humor as a form of play. Now, play is a form of activity that brings people together in a common emotional stance. If I'm playing with you, then you are playing with me, or else I'm not playing. I'm trying to play, but failing. If one of us is playing and the other one is not, then we are not playing. Playing is a symmetrical relationship. Recall Robert Latta's distinction between those approaches to humor that are stimulus side and those that are response side. A view is stimulus side if it looks for humor in the act of the joker. It looks at those who are trying to get the laughs. They ask questions like, what is a joke? Or where do jokes come from? The key is that for these views, humor is in the causing of the amusement. On the other hand, response side views look at the reaction. They locate humor in the audience. It's not the thing that makes us laugh, but in the processing and reasons why we laugh. Humor is not found in the actions of the joker, but in the response to him. Response side views ask questions like, why do we find someone hurting himself to be funny in slapstick, but not in real life? Or how do we know when something is a joke and not a serious comment? Humor is to be found and explained in terms of the one who finds something humorous. Play theory is unique amongst humor theories in that it is simultaneously both a stimulus side and a response side account. Humor is not in the joke or in the reaction to the joke, but in the relationship between the joker and the audience. Or, to be more precise, in the common stance adopted by both the act of telling and the act of receiving the joke. Play theorists found as their forefather one of the earliest of the great philosophers, Aristotle. Aristotle was a student of Plato. He studied with Plato at the academy for 20 years until Plato died, at which point he found Plato's lectures had become intolerably boring. But Aristotle was not a disciple of Plato. Recall that Plato had been a disciple of Socrates, and Plato's earliest works were an attempt to save the memory of his beloved teacher for posterity. Aristotle was different. He sought to undermine Plato's views of the world. Now, it's certainly true that there are significant places where their views overlap, but in crucial ways, they are very different. In Raphael's famous painting, The School of Athens, you see all the great minds of the classical Greek world gathered together. In the center of the painting, there are two figures, one older and pointing up, and the other younger and holding his hand out flat. The older figure is Plato, whose view was that what was real was not the material world, but the ethereal world of ideas, the world of the mind. Aristotle, on the other hand, saw this world, the real world, the world of material things, as the actual world. Their central metaphysical stances were a study in contrast. So too, were their views about humor. Recall that Plato was a superiority theorist. He held that humor is dangerous because it entails mocking another person. This leads the lower to wrongly assert their superiority over the superior. Just as fiction and drama is literally false and capable of putting wrong ideas in the head of its audience, so too with humor. Jokes are always at the expense of another, and this can lead to tragedy for humanity, such as the wrongful killing of the great Socrates by the Athenians, who had been poisoned by the comedy of Aristophanes. But for Aristotle, the view is quite different. In his great work on morality, the Nicomachean Ethics, humor could be a virtue. That is, it could be a part of the properly lived human life. To understand why, we need to understand Aristotle's notion of the soul. Everything living, Aristotle held, has a soul. The soul is the internal principle of change. So if a plant grows and develops from an acorn into an oak tree, there must have been an internal blueprint and power source guiding and driving that development. That would be the oak tree's soul. Every living thing has a soul, and the sort of soul is particular to the species it's a part of. Humans have souls that have four parts. The first part is the part we share with plants. It's the part that guides our basic processes of growth, respiration, digestion. Plants eat, breathe, and grow like we do, so we must share a soul with them. The second part of our soul we share with animals. This is the part that allows for perception and locomotion. Animals see, hear, smell, and run around. So do we. So we must have a part of our soul that is similar. But humans are different from plants and animals in that we reason. So we must have a part of our soul that is unlike the souls of plants and animals, a part that's exclusively human, the part that controls what we think and how we control how we act based on what we think. The first part is the intellectual part of the soul, and the virtues of it are to be found in the extreme, with respect to knowledge, intelligence, wisdom, problem-solving ability. More is always better. No one ever said, no, I shouldn't learn anything more. I'm already the perfect amount of smart. If I got smarter, I would be worse off. For the intellectual side of the human part of the soul, more is always better. But not so for the ethical side, what he called the practical side. Here, the extremes are vices, and the moderate path is virtuous. With respect to dangerous situations, you don't want to be cowardly, but neither do you want to be foolhardy. You want to be in the middle, brave. With respect to money, you don't want to be miserly, nor do you want to throw your money around, giving it all away and blowing it on needless stuff. You want the middle path. You want to be generous. With respect to ethical actions, Aristotle contends, the morally right way to be, the part that will actualize your potential to be the perfect person you could be, is to be found as the mean between two extremes. Moderation leads to maximizing your quality of life. And so it is, he contends, with respect to humor. One with no sense of humor is a bore and fails to fully appreciate the joys of human life. On the other extreme, one who jokes all the time and fails to be sufficiently serious is a buffoon. The perfect way of being a human is to be moderate in humor, to be witty. Plato may have thought humor dangerous, but his student Aristotle thought that the proper amount was necessary for the well-lived human life. One needed to be sufficiently playful to be truly human. Following Aristotle in this was St. Thomas Aquinas, which is completely unsurprising because Aquinas agreed with Aristotle on just about everything. After the so-called Dark Ages, the Christian world rediscovered the writings of Plato and Aristotle, and there was a several hundred year debate concerning which one should be considered the philosophical foundation for Christianity. Now, some following St. Augustine argued vociferously for a Platonic understanding of the world for Christians. Others, following Aquinas, argued for a Christianized Aristotelian worldview. Aquinas' supporters ultimately won the battle, and Aristotle's thought became officially sanctioned church doctrine. Aristotle's physics, for example, became the basis of scientific beliefs for the church, and Galileo's Copernicanism disagreed with it and famously landed him in trouble. On the topic of humor, we see Aquinas, in his masterwork Summa Theologia, again taking the side of Aristotle. In Christianity, there is certainly a strand of thought that is incredibly rigid in terms of avoiding bodily pleasure. There's the life of the soul and the life of the body. The life of the body, the life of sin, seeks the pleasures of the flesh. The proper way to be is to eschew such pleasures and live in awe and reverence. This line would clearly lead to a belief in the sinfulness of humor, of silliness. But that's not Aquinas' view. Like Aristotle, Aquinas sees the proper amount of play as essential for the properly lived life. To play too much is indeed a sin, but, Aquinas contends, so too is playing too little. God wants us to be pleasant. The good person, the person who lives the proper way, is not a dour bore. If we are created in the image of God, we should be of proper cheer. We should be happy, and our words should be interesting, thoughtful, and playful. He wrote,
"Amusement does have an aspect of good inasmuch as it is useful for human living. As a man sometimes needs to give his body rest from labors, so also he sometimes needs to rest his soul from mental strain that ensues from his application to serious affairs. This is done by amusement."
This sentiment would be echoed in the 17th century by the British writer Anthony Ashley Cooper, better known by his royal title, the 3rd Earl of Shaftesbury. Shaftesbury had issues with the religious fundamentalists of his day. The Puritans, Calvinists, and Quakers of this period demanded a stern, humorless existence if one was to be virtuous. But Shaftesbury asked if an all-loving God would really demand that his children not enjoy the lives he gave to them. To be given the gift of life and demand that it be lived in a way that did not avail one to the full range of delights one could experience during it was a waste of that life. We see in these early play theorists a religious or at least metaphysical basis for their view of humor, grounding it on that which is explicitly human. Humor is a sort of play that makes for a well-lived human life. It's essentially a human activity. Many contemporary play theorists, on the other hand, take a completely different approach, one that's not human-centric at all. Watch any nature documentary. Look at the cute baby animals. What are they doing? Playing. Chasing each other around, wrestling with each other. Play in young animals is an important part of life. It's in this play that they learn the essential skills necessary for hunting, for self-defense, for establishing themselves socially in the hierarchy of the group. Play is training. Without play, the young will not grow into successful adult members of the species. But play is just play. The animals know the difference between play wrestling and real conflict. They know that they're trying to dominate the other, to pin the other down with the soft, fleshy belly showing, to run faster and catch or escape from the other. They're putting full effort into the play. They want to win, but they also know when to pull back so they don't injure or kill their playmate. They are playing. Playing is when we operate under a mutual understanding that what we are doing is, in a certain fashion, removed from real life. We're in a special space, what philosopher William Fry called a play frame, which operates by play rules. When you're in the play frame, you agree to certain ways of acting, certain prohibitions or requirements. Even animals understand this. Anthropologists see this behavior in other animals and infer that it must also be the case for humans. Certainly it is the case that, just like animals, we humans play much more when we're young than when we're grown up. Children's imaginations are a marvel. They can play with anything. Everything's a toy. Every moment an opportunity to imagine a scenario. Adult brains are less playful. Adults are so reliant on the conceptual framework by which we make sense of the world that we're loath to reimagine things as being other than we think they are. The human mind ossifies as we age. We get less creative, less imaginative, and less playful. Play theorists who contend that humor is a form of play can point to not only the decrease in play in general as humans age, but also the marked decrease in the typical reaction to humor, laughter, as we age. Kids laugh often, and in a way that adults rarely do. Watch children laugh. They laugh with their whole body, their whole being. Adults laugh in a fashion that generally allows us to maintain control of ourselves. Psychologist Robert Provine has studied laughter, and his research has shown that most adult laughter is not a response to anything funny. Most adult laughter is not in any way a response to humor. Rather, it's what Provine calls a social lubricant. We laugh as a social signal to other adults to show our lack of aggressiveness, our desire to form a bond of friendship, or our submissiveness. Provine studies rates of laughter and causes of laughter in adult conversation. Most often, laughter happens when nothing funny has been said, and the laughter is a generated laugh. He looks at how often men laugh when talking to women and other men, and how often women laugh when talking to men and to other women. Probably comes as no surprise that women laugh most often when talking to men, and men laugh most often when talking to other men. It's not, as some have contended, that men are funny and women are not. The cause of the laugh is rarely anything resembling humor. Rather, the laughing is meant to put the other person at ease or to signal our interest in appeasing the other person and seeking their confirmation of our relationship. Anthropologists of humor try to understand humor in terms of behavior like this. That laughter may be a universal signal that has evolved in our psyche from our earliest experiences surviving in the world. Recall that in the third lecture of this series, we looked at the hypothesis that laughing and smiling, typical responses to humor, arose from behaviors that allowed us to communicate a lack of danger. There are facts that are important to communicate in groups. This is easy to do when you have language, abstract symbols, and social media. For animals without Facebook, like the other great apes or my parents, the transmission must be recognizably behavioral. As such, certain behaviors become contagious. That, interestingly, is Robert Provine's larger research project, Contagious Social Behaviors. I know this because in college, I was one of his test subjects. Not for his humor work, but for his study of a different contagious behavior, yawning. No, he did not conduct it during his Psych 101 class. But he had me in a dark room watching a videotape, yes, this was back when there was videotape, of people yawning. And one of his graduate students keeping track of how long it took me to yawn and how often I would do it, seeing other people yawn. The other contagious behavior he studied is passing gas. To our inner second grader, that is funny. The idea is that its contagiousness was necessary to get the whole group out of high alert mode, something that has survival value. Now, some anthropologists surmise that the birth of human humor was the ability to recognize the alert and relaxation effects of the calls and to manipulate one's group mates by falsely putting them on alert, pretending there's danger when there's not, only then to give the all clear, resulting in relieved laughter. The first jokes were sorts of practical jokes that used the signals in a playful way. Just as young animals were playing when they wrestled, taking themselves out of real life and pretending to fight, so too the adults could pretend there is a danger only to relieve the stress when the other came to realize there was not. Maybe this is correct, maybe it isn't. Claims involving evolutionary psychology are notoriously difficult to support with direct evidence. But it does fit with what we now know about how to get laughs from an audience. It's easier to get laughs from people who trust you. This is why comedians will often do crowd work early in their set. Before launching into their material, they'll chat with the crowd. Sometimes they make jokes about audience members. Sometimes they just engage them in a lighthearted way. What this does is build a connection between them. It's always easier to get your friends to crack up than it is to get a laugh from a stranger whose guard is up. So, comics try to make the audience members into acquaintances, if not friends. Being in a group makes it easier to get laughs. When you get one person laughing, the others are more likely to laugh. Being drunk makes it more likely that you'll find something funny. Comedy clubs have a two-drink minimum and a full bar, not only to make money on booze, which they do, but because it relaxes people. When you've had a few, your adult inhibitions are let down. Drunk people are more like their old child selves, and thereby much more likely to laugh. Blue rooms are more likely to produce easier audiences for comedians than red rooms. Dark, smaller rooms also produce audiences that are more likely to laugh. Feeling safe makes it more likely that you will find something funny. When we're angry, upset, scared, or worried, we're less likely to see the humor in something, even something really funny. And when we do find something funny, we're less angry, upset, scared, or worried. Play occurs in a play frame, a removed context, separated from real life. When the troubles of life are present before our minds, we do not consent to stepping out of real life because we feel there are dangers that require our attention. But when we do surrender to the play frame, we feel a sense of relaxation and joy. Play theorists argue that the anthropological and psychological evidence points to an account of humor that makes it a species of the general phenomenon of play. This is even present in our linguistic explanations, right? If someone is joking, they'll say, look, I'm only playing around. This, play theorists contend, should be taken very much literally. Is play theory a successful account of humor? Is an account of humor as play giving us necessary and sufficient conditions? Well, clearly, play theory is not sufficient, right? Not all play is humor. Poets play with words. Engineers play with designs. This isn't humor. We can play with all sorts of things without any sense of humor resulting. But is play necessary? A stronger case can be made here. The place to look is someone we mentioned earlier, the father of contemporary play theory, the Dutch thinker Johan Huizinga. In 1938, he published his book Homo Ludens. Ludens is the root word for our word ludicrous, but translates more or less as play. Human beings are playful men. Play is at the heart of who we are. Huizinga says that it's true that other animals exhibit play-like behaviors, but we really don't laugh when we see two dogs chasing each other around the yard. There's something unique and important about human play. Human play is special. Human play preceded human culture, but every element of human culture is thoroughly filled with and built around play. Human play, Huizinga contends, is built around four elements. The first is freedom. When we play, we free ourselves from the usual strictures of society. I wasn't being serious, I was only playing, we might say when we're caught breaking the rules of etiquette. The reason we say this is that when we play, we allow ourselves to move beyond usual boundaries and strictures. Philosophers of sport, who make use of Huizinga's work, point out that on the playing field, we can hit people or trick people in ways that are allowed and celebrated, but which would be condemned off the field. A hockey player can smash someone into the boards to the praise of fans and commentators, but do that in the line at the bank, and the response will be different. Similarly, philosophers of humor who make use of Huizinga's ideas say the same thing is true of joking. Joking as an act is, as we sing and says, an act of freedom that removes us from our usual moral boundaries. While play creates freedom in removing us from the constraints of the culture, the second element that defines it is its insistence on its own new rules. Play may free us up from our regular expectations, but it comes with its own. But we're free to make them up as we go. There is a new order. Think of playing make-believe with a child. In this world we're creating, I'm no longer a philosophy professor and your father. I'm now an ogre. And you're no longer my daughter, but a fairy princess. You can fly, but I can't. A new order is imposed, and what makes the play world is the order we design and impose on it as we choose. Just as in sports, where we set up a goal and then enforce rules that eliminate the easiest way to achieve the goal, so too with jokes. They constantly present new cognitive elements that the listener has to struggle to weave into a coherent new world she considers. The third important aspect for play, for Fuisinga, is that it creates its own play world. It's removed from the day-to-day life. Again, philosophers of sport point out the way in which the field of play is its own universe, set off from the rest of the real world. Just as sports occur in a dedicated space, a field, a pitch, or a court, humor creates its own dedicated space. That is, it puts us in a play frame, an artistic play space removed from the real world. We don't bat an eye at talking sheep or horses walking into a bar to order a beer. The final element is that play is not pay. When we play, we remove ourselves from our usual wants and desires. We're not playing to gain anything. Play is its own reward. When we look at jokes, the idea is that humor is not meant to say anything, not meant to convey any information. It's just meant to get a laugh, to be fun. Jokes are a form of Huizinga's play because the joke is a self-contained pleasure nugget. So, with this sense of play and with our understanding of what humor is and humor does, play theorists contend that in order for an act to be an act of humor, it must be playful. I suppose that means if there is a comedy on the stage, then the players who are playing in the play are playing when they're playing in the play, since they would have to be play within the play for the players to play, or else the play would not be humorous.
Lecture 13, Relief Theory.
Hey, you about ready?
All right.
Hey, so, hey, Steve. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Banana.
Banana who?
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 Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Banana.
Yeah, we're definitely ready to control room.
All right, here we go. Action!
In attempting to explicate the notion of humor, that is, find a necessary and sufficient set of conditions that define what it is for an act to be humorous, we distinguish between those views that are, in Robert Latta's terms, stimulus side and response side. The view we will examine in this lecture, relief theory or release theory, is purely response side. Humor, these thinkers want to argue, is a matter of how it affects the mind and the listener. Humor is the result of the mind summoning up energy and resources to solve what it initially sees as a difficult puzzle, only to then realize that it's a joke, and thus to have lots of energy it doesn't need. The body then releases that extra energy as explosive laughter. Humor is the relief we feel from releasing the unnecessary mental energy. The first thinker associated with this view is the Reverend Francis Hutcheson. Hutcheson was a Scotch-Irish philosopher who was one of the founding fathers of the Scottish Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was an intellectual movement that swept over Europe in the 17th and 18th century and placed the foundation of its worldview on a picture of humanity as essentially rational. To be human is to have the capacity for reason. This seems obvious, almost trivial to us. Indeed, long before the Enlightenment, we humans were differentiating ourselves from the rest of nature because of our ability to think. But in the hands of Hutcheson and others, the idea was quite revolutionary. If reason is what makes us human, and all humans have it, then humans must all be thought to be of equal status. Political, economic, and religious structures before that had been based on absolute classes of people. Some people are better than others, royal, holier, wealthier. But the Enlightenment put us all on the same footing. This was the intellectual impetus behind the development of modern democratic theory, trial by jury, and free market capitalism. People are rational. Give them the information, and they will pick the best leader, decide the best verdict, pick the best product at the best price. It also had a profound influence on religion. If we're radically equal, then this ought to influence our relation with the divine. We ought to have individual relationships with God, not needing a structure to mediate our connection for us. We don't need to go through a priest, the bishop, or the pope. We should all have equal access to God, and God will have made us equal in this way for a reason. Humans are rational because the universe is rational. A perfect God would have created a perfectly rational universe. The reason we all have the faculty of reason is to be able to fully appreciate the majesty and grandeur of God's creation. God gave us faculties of perception and reason so that we can see and admire His perfection. We love order. We're bothered by chaos. We love harmony. We're bothered by randomness. We seek structure in the working of the universe and see beauty in the world when we find it. Symmetry is soothing. Flaws are disturbing. All of this is because God is perfect, and we have the rationality to appreciate it. Hutcheson takes this as the heart of his view of art. Good art is symmetric, ordered, has a sense of flow, as we now say. Good art is appreciated because our sense of beauty is shaped by our reason. This, Hutcheson argues, explains why we love jokes. Humor occurs when the mind originally senses conflict, disharmony, confusion, but then realizes the way out. Let's again think about verbal jokes.
What is eternal love? It's a tennis match between Ray Charles and Stevie Wonder.
The setup leads you to think about something. The punchline then causes cognitive discord because the punchline and the initial interpretation of the setup do not work together. When we think of eternal love, we think of a human, care-based relationship based on adoration. When we hear the punchline, we can't see why we're suddenly talking about tennis or two very talented blind performers. It makes no sense. There's a puzzle, a hard task we'll need to figure out. The mind summons up sufficient energy to devote resources needed to solving this difficult problem. But then we get the joke. Oh, love as in zero in tennis, not love as in a caring relationship. Of course, tennis would be hard if you couldn't see the ball. When we get the joke, the puzzle turns out not to be a puzzle. There's no difficult cognitive task to accomplish. It was a trick played on the mind. But the mind now has all this energy it summoned. What to do with it? Shoot it out as laughter. Humor is the process by which we summon and then release unneeded energy. We think that there's disorder, but it turns out to be a very cleverly hidden order that we discover when we get the joke. For this reason, Hutcheson holds humor to be a tool for self-improvement. There are two kinds of people out there, those who can laugh at themselves and those who cannot. It is important, Hutcheson holds, to be able to laugh at yourself. When I'm the butt of a joke, it does hurt my feelings. But the reason for this is that the joke at my expense is exposing a flaw in me. A flaw is something that's out of order, something that's not in accord with the perfection of God's creation. If I'm capable of laughing at myself, it means that I must be able to see and understand these flaws. I get what is out of order with myself, and once I know it, I can fix it. If I refuse to laugh at myself, it means that I refuse to acknowledge my flaws. It's only by owning them that I can transcend them. Being able to laugh at yourself is an important part of being able to better yourself. On a side note, do you know why we say love for zero in tennis? Think of how we colloquially say zero in English. If you scored nothing, we say, you got the old goose egg, because the digit for zero is an oval. Egg in French is ouf, and the egg is l'œuf. Love is just borrowing of l'œuf into English. We mispronounce it as love. So, anyway, Francis Hutcheson derives the relief theory of humor from his Enlightenment worldview, according to which humans are rational beings. While he was the first, he's not the most well-known relief theorist. The name most strongly associated with the relief theory of humor is actually most famous for his work undermining the Enlightenment view of humans. That is Sigmund Freud. Freud loved a good joke. One of his favorites.
So the king's walking amongst his subjects, and he sees a man who looks exactly like him. And the king asks the man, "Did your mother work in the palace?" The man replies, "No, but my father did."
Not only a good joke, but how much more Freudian can you get? But Freud not only enjoyed a good joke, he wrote an entire book on the subject, Jokes and Their Relation to the Unconscious. Freud, like Hutcheson, sees humor as the release of unused mental energy, but he has a completely different understanding as to where this energy comes from. For Freud, humor makes sense in terms of his tripartite picture of the human mind. Freud thinks that our minds are composed of three parts: the ego, the id, and the superego. Ego is the Latin word for self. The ego is the part of the mind that's transparent to the individual. When we say, "I made up my mind," or "I have this in mind," the ego is the part of the mind we're talking about. It's the part of the mind you see, that you have access to and control over when you think about something. Enlightenment thinkers thought that the ego was the whole of the mind. We are rational beings. Our minds are open to the world, and we are open to the mind. By identifying humanity with rationality, we're asserting that the mind works in a well-ordered way, and that we can see all of the gears and cogs and springs as they do what they do. But Freud's psychoanalytic approach saw the mind quite differently. The ego is just one part, and not even the most interesting part. The id is the animal part. We evolved from animals, and that history has stayed with us. We are part animal, and we have the urges, drives, and desires that other animals have. Food, drink, sex, warmth, affection, control, revenge. We are a walking soap opera, or, as we call it these days, the news. But while the id is driving these urges and cravings, it remains a part of the subconscious. We have desires and yearning we don't even know we have. We want things we don't know we want. Our minds, and thus our motivations for doing the things we do, are not completely available to us. Now, if this is true, then this undermines the Enlightenment project that motivates Hutcheson. If there's a part of our minds that we don't see, and that leads us to act in certain ways that we don't consciously realize, then we are not purely rational. Our decisions and actions could possibly seem rational to us, but actually be irrationally controlled by this invisible part of our mind. Consider democratic processes. We could vote for the presidential candidate that we believe we support for purely rational reasons, but really, unbeknownst to ourselves, actually be motivated by non-rational factors such as bigotry, hatred, lust, fear, or revenge. And if this is possible, then researchers could figure out how to make use of this fact, candidates could hire psychologically savvy consultants who would help them shape their campaigns, not to appeal to the rational part of the mind, but rather to this darker part of ourselves. They could possibly even convince us to vote against our own self-interest, create images and ideas that egg on the id, leading it to override the ego, and by feeding our primal emotions, leading us to possibly even elect someone we rationally would reject. Now, I'm not saying this is or has ever been the case, but if there are subconscious elements like Freud's id, it would be possible. The id is not the only subconscious element in the human mind, according to Freud. There's also the superego. The superego is the conscience. There's a part of us that drives us to be the perfect self we could be. It's shaped by parents and by the culture, and it's where the moral and social norms reside. The superego is the part of the mind that motivates us to do good things, to be empathetic and care about others, to give and sacrifice. It also makes the part of the mind that makes us feel guilty when we're not the perfect selves we could be. It's interesting that Sigmund Freud would include an invisible, ever-present Jewish mother inside the human mind. The id and superego are both operating below the threshold of consciousness. They are always busy at work, but we never notice them humming away. In taking care of their assigned tasks, the id and superego may clash. The id tells the mind that it has desire for something. The superego tells the mind it cannot pursue. Do not give in to that primal urge. You're better than that, the superego will tell you. But you really want to. But you also want not to. Sometimes this conflict is present in the conscious mind. Ooh, that donut looks good. But these pants are getting a little tight. Indeed, sometimes the id not only tells the ego that it should ignore the suggestion of the id, but denies that the id has put the suggestion in the mind at all. Not only do you not want to do that, your superego will tell you, but you're not even the sort of person who would want that. It's not just summoning the willpower to keep from engaging in whatever debauchery the id suggests, but beyond that, denying that you even have the desire. But oftentimes these conflicts between the id and superego stay below the level at which the ego can see them. Behind the scenes, there's a struggle going on with one invisible part of your mind trying to get you to go and the other invisible part of your mind trying to get you to stop. The struggle requires energy in two ways. First, the tug of war requires mental energy. Both parts are spending energy pushing its agenda and pushing against the other part. Second, the mind spends mental energy to keep these elements and their conflict out of sight of the ego, suppressing them, maintaining their location in a place that keeps them from consciousness, that takes energy too. This fight between the id and the superego, if it becomes intense enough, can break the mind. Neuroses are the effect of the subconscious element's war going over the line. When the subconscious conflict becomes too overwhelming, the results are strange behaviors we have no sense of why we're doing. We're compelled to do things, seemingly for no good reason. But surely there is a reason. Freud thought that psychoanalysis was the way for a trained psychiatric professional to look into the subconscious and see what the ego of the patient could not. From the seat of the therapist, the mind of the patient could be plumbed, and the source of the motivation for the peculiar behaviors could be determined. My favorite example from Freud's writings involves a patient he called Ratman, a nickname he gave to this patient due to his obsessive torture fantasies involving rats. He was probably not very fun at parties. One summer, Ratman had taken his girlfriend and his American cousin Richard on holiday. During the vacation, he suddenly and inexplicably found himself compelled to exercise strenuously. He would work out with weights and run long distance in the heat. He couldn't keep himself from unusually intense physical activity. Freud put him on the couch and claimed to have found the reason. The girlfriend had been showing a lot of attention to the cousin and Ratman felt jealous. His id wanted to eliminate the cousin. But he couldn't even entertain the idea that he'd want to murder his cousin. So the mind had to find some other way to express that urge. The cousin, Richard, went by the nickname